Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes, and this morning I'm speaking with a wonderful guest, author, journalist Linda Pullman. Many of you might have heard about her. She's been making a lot of people upset. I just told her she was airing their dirty laundry, so she has to be a little careful where she goes probably. But I want people to learn about what's going on with aid. A lot of times you give aid, you don't know what actually happens to your money. And her book, The Crisis Caravan, What's Wrong with Humanitarian Aid, really gives you a wide view of what's happening with your money, what's happening with the aid workers, what are their motives, with the governments of these different countries all over the globe, Africa, Asia, even in Europe. She opens the book with a quote here: "The humane desire to lighten a little the torments of all these poor wretches creates a kind of energy which gives one a positive craving to relieve as many as one can." This is from Henry Dunant, a humanitarian aid worker and founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross. I also want to read a little bit from that beginning section. This is one of the reasons he started the Red Cross. "Bodies of men and horses covered the battlefield. Corpses were strewn over roads, ditches, ravines, thickets, and fields. The approaches to Solferino were literally thick with dead. The poor wounded men were ghostly pale and exhausted. Some who had gaping wounds already beginning to show infection were almost crazed with suffering." This is the beginning of Linda Pullman's book, The Crisis Caravan. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling in. You're all the way in Holland, the other part of the globe, making a lot of changes, ruffling a lot of feathers over there.
Yes. The book appeared in quite a few countries already. And I am proud and happy to say that in all those countries, the book has created a stir, because the feeling that you just described, this craving that we all have, that we want to help the poor and the suffering on this planet, I mean, we all have it. It's a universal thing. And this is why it is so shocking for people everywhere to find out that aid does not always get to the people in the places that we intended it to.
So why did you write this book? Why did you think it was necessary? Couldn't you just be like the people in the book? Well, okay, it's happening. I don't have any power control. Why did you feel like it was necessary to write this book?
Because I do think that we can actually change. We can make aid better. The solutions have already been thought of by the aid organizations themselves. I'm sure we can talk about that a bit later. The reason why I wrote the book is I am a journalist. I'm going to war zones and conflict zones for already many, many years, so I see this suffering. I also see the aid organizations who come into those zones and who interfere with that suffering, with our money. What actually happened is I was a correspondent for Dutch newspapers in Sierra Leone in West Africa. I was there when the civil war there was still going on. This was in 1999. In 2000, there was a peace accord signed between the government and the rebel movement in Sierra Leone, meaning that the international community made a lot of aid money available for the rebuilding of the country. Now, when I was in Sierra Leone during the war, the country was literally very, very dark. There was no gasoline left, so people had no money had no gas to fill their generators. There was no electricity. There was no radio because people could not afford batteries, etc. So the country was in silence and it was dark. And when those aid organizations moved in with all the aid money, I could see the country change within a very, very short time. Within 2 weeks, more than 200 international aid organizations moved in.
Wow.
With caravans of white Land Rovers, white people inside them. And at first, I was really excited because I could see the change. I could hear generators starting up. There was electricity going on. The white people started aid projects. They opened restaurants, you know, because white people want to eat well. The hotels went open. The golf course in Freetown, the capital, opened up. So I thought, well, this is great. We are rescued, you know. Mm. Until I noticed who were the people exactly who had access to all that international aid money, and we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars here. It was the political elite in Sierra Leone. It was the people that were responsible for the war and for the duration of the war.
Not the little people, not the people who really needed it, were not in control.
Exactly, mm-hmm. The business elite, you know, the people that during the war were making their money with arms and with blood diamonds. After the war, they were making their money with bringing goods and services to the international aid organizations. It was the rebel movement, you know, the people that had been running around with machetes to hack people's hands off.
Yeah, they were the ones.
Yeah. Aid projects. And I thought this couldn't be right. How can it be that the poor and the vulnerable do not have access to the aid money? Why is it the people that were guilty during the war? So I went to other aid operations in Congo and in Haiti and in Afghanistan, and every time again I saw the same process. It is the local elites, the people who are in power in places, who actually have access to the aid organizations and the aid money. And if we're talking about crisis and war zones here, that means that the local elites are people who are, in fact, the ones who are fighting the war, and they will use the aid money to continue their war, and they will use it against their enemies.
Yes.
So
let me.
It's not reaching the poor and vulnerable per se.
Linda, let me just read a little bit. Let's start. One of the things I want to tell the audience, actually, you know what, I'm going to go there first, is one of the, as a parent, I have a child, and one of the chapters in your book, Donor Darlings, really touched me. I mean, I was like with trepidation. I didn't want to continue to read because
yeah.
I didn't want to hear what story you were going to tell me about what's happening with these children. And this is, again, in all areas. In Linda's book, again, it's a wide sweeping book. She looks at Africa. She looks at Asia. She looks at Russia. She looks at Palestine. She's going all over the globe. So really it's important that you read this to understand what's going on. But I want to read a little section from Donor Darlings. What I need, said the shopkeeper Abu, is a child. I always bought my beer at his kiosk in town. I asked him what he needed a child for. Oh, to fetch me water for me, to sweep the floor, and to sleep in the shop and chase away thieves, he replied. Tomorrow I'm going to get myself a nice one. I didn't really want to know, but I asked anyway, where are you going to get a child like that? In Murraytown camp, he answered. You give the chairman some money, you promise to send the child to school, and then you can take one with you. Linda, you kill me with that chapter. I mean, just for the...
I know, and being a witness to it also killed me, but I decided not to sit there crying, and I decided to put it on paper. Because, I mean, the only way that we can actually change things is by awareness. We have to know what is going on, and we have to analyze what is going on, and only then we can make things better. So we have to face up to this truth. In war zones, and in poor countries in general, but in war zones, children are a target. They are a target of, they are a prey. The reason why children are donor darlings is because it is so easy to raise aid money by showing us pictures of children, you know, with the flies in their nose and the big bellies, you know. In Sierra Leone, the donor darlings were children that had their limbs hacked off by rebels.
Yes.
Aid organizations that were not even working for these children, they used pictures of those children to raise money, to raise our money. So those children are targeted by aid organizations. And local people, they know this, you know, they see the children as merchandise. They know that they can raise money with children. They know that these children can be sold to aid organizations, literally also. Those children in Sierra Leone, most children that were amputated in Sierra Leone, disappeared. They were taken by white aid organizations, and for many children we don't know where they were taken. They were just picked up by a white Land Rover and they disappeared. There is in fact quite a group in New York at the moment who were also taken from that camp. At least we know where they ended up, but their parents in the first instance didn't.
They're very vulnerable, and one of the things that the fallacy that you bust wide open with the book is that these children don't have parents. One of the issues in the Donor Darlings chapter is that they didn't have prosthetics. So these organizations were coming in and saying, oh, well, they don't have prosthetics, so we're going to give them the best prosthetics. And then, you know, one of the doctors that you interviewed was like, they already have prosthetics. They don't wear them. They throw them in the road so that they can get more aid. So it's like this manipulation back and forth between the person who actually needs help, but then other people, you know, taking advantage of that. And children are helpless. The one character that you talk about, what's his name? Simpson. Is his name Simpson?
Yes.
Oh, I don't like him. I do not like him at all. I don't know him, but I don't like him. Linda, you made me not like him.
Yes. But, I mean, mind you, this Mr. Simpson was one of a growing movement inside the AIDS industry, a growing movement of American religious organizations, most of them from the southern part of the United States. They grow up like mushrooms, you know. They are everywhere because it is so easy within church movements to raise money to do good things in Africa for the poor people, you know. So it is that group of American religious organizations that are actually to be found in every single disaster zone doing things that they are not accountable for. I've seen them move into disaster zones and they start operating on people, you know, and they don't provide the aftercare or nothing because they decided to come to Africa for a week only. So people that were left after the operations, they had no aftercare. They were left there bleeding.
Yeah, you talk about there. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So I mean, there are many American groups that actually go to Africa to do their own divine thing, and they actually believe that God has sent them to do the divine thing. Most of the amputated children were also from Sierra Leone were also taken by American religious groups. So it is something that American people should take responsibility for. It is important to know that these groups are there, that there are more and more groups like that, and it is important to be alert, you know. If there is fundraising in your church or something, you have to be very, very aware that your money can actually be spent by amateurs who have no clue where they're going.
Linda, let me talk a little bit here. This is another section of your book in the beginning, Contract Fever, and this is a quote. And again, I just want to emphasize, you are not pointing just one organization out. You go all over the place and show how it's not just one area of the globe and it's not just one organization that this is happening in. It's happening in religious organizations and INGOs all over the place. And no matter what the country, whether it's in a Dutch country or French country or American country, these organizations are coming in. And let me just read this here. This is from the Dutch MSF. Dutch MSF unnecessarily exaggerated the misery in its reports about the eviction of refugees from camps in Goma in November 1996. We are guilty of carelessly bandying figures about, Voss says. In the magazine Sponsorship and Fundraising, he points to a figure of more than 1 million victims. That arose from the feeling that here's a disaster so great that you can't tackle it on your own as an aid organization. You need large-scale military logistics, international intervention. And then a figure of 10,000 victims comes over as less convincing than 1 million or even more. Fundraisers use figures the way they are used in the world of advertising, where hyperbole is a way of selling products, Voss claims. I wonder whether this is a matter of ethical dilemma or shrewdness. So what you break open is that these aid organizations, and you go Red Cross, Dutch, you know, French, you know, all over, are inflating the figures about what's happening so that they can get money. And earlier in the conversation, you talked about, you know, the hotels springing up and golf clubs and things like that. But who's using those facilities? The white aid organization people in suits, the elite of the country who started the war. Talk to me a little bit about the organizations inflating the numbers in your experience.
Well, what we must realize when we want to support aid organizations, we have to realize that aid is an industry. You have more than 70 donor governments. My government is one, the Dutch government, but the American government is the biggest donor government on this planet. Mm-hmm. You have about 70 donor governments who combined make available $130 billion per year for foreign aid. On top of that is all the money that we take out of our pocket to support our own favorite charities with. This could amount to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions more per year. Nobody knows how much, because there's no law that says that you have to keep up your books. So you are talking about a multi-billion dollar industry of a lot of money through a lot of channels from a lot of countries. Now, the United Nations once made an effort to count how many international aid organizations are there to help spend those billions of dollars. And they stopped counting at 37,000 organizations.
Wow.
So you have thousands and thousands of organizations, billions and billions of dollars. You can imagine that those thousands of organizations are, in fact, in competition with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They have to make sure that their own organization gets a larger share of all those, of all the billions, than the competing organizations. You have right now in Haiti, for example, there are more than 400 aid organizations, medical aid organizations, so who provide medical aid, more than 400. So it is important for those 400 organizations that they attract attention of donors, our attention, but also the attention of our government, because otherwise we and our government will give our money to a competing organization. So
it's like a business. This is just big business, but with the label of aid and kind of empathy. And, you know, I think in the book what I got, Linda, is a lot of these people have big egos, and they don't want to lose, even though at the cost of aiding war. They don't want to lose face with their donors, so they keep, you know, emphasizing,
yes,
you know, the horror over so, but not,
yes,
telling people that one of the things Linda brings up in the book is that aid organizations are hiring soldiers. Aid organizations are hiring soldiers as employees.
Yes. I mean, yes, this is true. And you cannot, being an aid organization, you cannot admit to your donors, which could also be us, because we support them too with the money that we take from our pockets.
Right.
So they cannot admit to their donors that these things are happening, because it might change our minds about them. So these things are, for a very large part, are unknown. They are kept unknown. The aid organizations themselves obviously know that this is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we, the donors and the donor governments, they don't know that this is going on. Because then we might give our money to another aid organization. So there you are, yes. You have to keep the dirty secret, the dirty laundry inside.
I think I have a question here. Let me pick up the call here. Good morning. You're calling from 215-804 number. You have a question?
Good morning. Yes, I do. I have a question for Ms. Pullman. I was hoping she could give us an example of a country who rejected outside aid and decided to make changes in their existing infrastructure to address their problems, a country that could be a model for others wishing to improve their situation.
Thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
Joy, I'm sorry, but could you repeat that question, because I couldn't hear it.
Okay, she asked, is there a country in the globe that refused aid and is doing good work as a best practice example to other countries who are in conflict?
Well, no, there's no country that will refuse aid altogether, but a country like India, for example, is growing into being a donor country itself. So for public relations purposes, India is accepting less and less international aid money to come in, because they want to show the world that they can take care of themselves and they are a growing country worth investing in. So India has been refusing money from, for example, the Dutch government, but India is still accepting a lot of aid from the American government. So yes, there are examples where countries who are on the way up, who want to be accepted with the big industrial countries, who start to accept less aid. But in general, it is not very wise for a poor country to admit that it is building itself up, because that means that donor countries will shift their attention to other countries,
and
you will miss out on aid programs.
Well, in your book,
the growing welfare in your country is something to keep secret because it will scare away donors.
Well, one of the things also in your book, you mentioned one of MSF France did step out of an area because they did get overwhelmed and disgusted with what was going on there and the corruption that was going on. So there are some organizations that are saying, you know what, I'm not going to be complicit. I'm not going to work in this context to help the rebels.
That's true. But mind you, an organization like MS France did make this ethical decision in a few instances, but there are many places where MSF stays on because it is not in their interest to leave. So sometimes they make the ethical decision, sometimes they don't. And what worries me is that it is up to them entirely to make the ethical decision or not.
Let me read from the back of your book. This is in one of your afterwords, just for the people who are not familiar with the Geneva Convention. Humanitarian community is obliged under international law to ensure that it is in full control of its resources and thus minimize contribution to the war economy. Article 23 of the Geneva Convention 4 specifies that a party shall allow free passage of certain goods through its territory, subject to the condition that this party is satisfied that there are no serious reasons for fearing that consignments might be diverted from their destinations, control might not be effective. I mean, all these things that you said all have not happened. People, the people who are controlling the war stop and control the resources. They don't let people fly in. They don't let people cross the border. When they get to the border, they jump on their trucks and take the resources. 80% in some cases don't even make it to the towns that need to get it. In the chat room, people are asking, you know, what can be done and who's the oversight? We only have a couple minutes left. What's some of your closing words, Linda?
Yes. Well, what can be done is an important thing. Aid organizations themselves have done all the math. You know, they have analyzed and evaluated all of their humanitarian aid operations. Aid organizations know exactly what the book is about. They don't need my book to tell them what is wrong. Mm. In their evaluations, all the solutions are there. I'm not saying that a perfect world is possible and perfect aid world is possible, but I am saying that improvements can be made. And one of the weak points of the aid industry is that they are, in fact, operating like an industry. They are in competition with each other, meaning that often they don't make an ethical choice, but they make a choice that is in their own interest. They make a choice because they are in competition with each other. So they don't make their victims the priority, but they make their own organization the priority. So it is very, very important that we are all aware of this and that we demand from the aid organizations that we serve to explain to us exactly how they think they can prevent their aid money to be abused by rebels and abused by warlords, etc. They have to deliver us some proof. They have to convince us that they are the aid organizations worth our support, that they are the aid organization who's actually taking responsibility for the consequences of their aid. So ask questions. That is the first step we should do. We should be aware that this is happening, and we should ask them a lot of questions before we entrust them with our $10 or with our $100. We have to be responsible. It is our money, and we have to demand the same responsibility for aid organizations.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book is Afghanistan. There's just so much in your book. People really need to pick it up. The Crisis Caravan, What's Wrong with Humanitarian Aid, by Linda Pullman. I'm giving away a free copy of her book. If you're interested in a free copy of her book, you need to email me Florence Nightingale's date of birth. Florence Nightingale, one of the biggest historical figures in aid, she actually agrees with Linda Pullman about what's happening today. That was a long time ago. It's still happening. This is not something new, and that's one of the things that Linda Pullman's book shows, is that historically with aid, no matter where it was in the globe, is dealing with the issue of being taken over by the people who are creating the war. And so she's asking us as citizens, when we give our money, to really look into the organizations and ask them to, show us proof that it's really helping and not supporting a negative cause. I want to thank you so much, Linda, for calling on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me in the show. It was my pleasure entirely.
I hope you stay in touch, and any new projects you have, please stay in touch, okay?
I'm going to Haiti in January for further investigations.
Oh, wow. We really want to know about Haiti because in America we give so much money to Haiti and it's blocked. You hear about blockades, can't even get into the land.
So, there's some strange things happening there, let me tell you. Yeah, I'll report back to you.
You report back to me. We'll come back on the show and talk about Haiti, all right?
Wonderful. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you, and you too. Goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I was just speaking with journalist and author Linda Pullman live from Holland. I'm giving away a free copy of her book, The Crisis Caravan, What's Wrong with Humanitarian Aid. So if you want a free copy, you need to email me the birth date of Florence Nightingale. You can email me at saturdaywithjoykeys@hotmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. Just look up twitter.com/joykeys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I just want to let you guys know that I really appreciate your support and listening to the show. Right now, I'm at 40,000 downloads of the show. It's just been an amazing year for me, and I think that all has to do with you guys, your listeners, no matter where you are. You're in Italy, you're in Germany, you're in the U.S., you're in Canada. I really appreciate you listening to the show, supporting the guests that I've had on the show. I mean, I've just had so many wonderful guests on the show that it takes my breath away, the knowledge that has come on this show. So I hope that you're supporting the various people. Linda Pullman, I just spoke with Dr. Julianne Malveaux, her new book, Surviving and Thriving. I'm giving away a free copy of that. Also, you need to email me Madam C.J. Walker's date of birth if you want a free copy of Dr. Julianne Malveaux's Surviving and Thriving book. But coming up next, I'm going to be having another author, another great talent, a newbie in the world of, books. His name is Craig T. Williams, and he is the author of The Olympian. He's talking about one of the first African-American Olympians who won a gold medal for the U.S. He was on the Olympic team. He went to the University of Pennsylvania. He actually became a veterinarian, got his degree as a veterinarian, and but he was an Olympian. And some of his heroes were Jack Johnson at the time. Many of you may know Jack Johnson, famous African-American boxer. So the book is just a wonderful – it's a historical fiction, though, so some things are true and some things are not. One of the things I want to read from here is a section that where the character – his name is James Taylor – gets it's a quote from Du Bois. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. The history of the African-American Negro is the history of this strife, this longing to attain self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better and truer self. In this merging, he wishes neither of the older selves to be lost. Well, in the book The Olympian, James Taylor is dealing with this issue. He's a lone soldier at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's questioned at every turn. He can't go even eat there. When he goes on trips with his team to the Olympics, to certain areas, he has to be in the Negro quarters. He can't even be with his team when he's traveling. So he deals with a lot of issues. One of the issues he deals with is that he was accused of cheating. And he decides to actually resign from the University of Pennsylvania. He decides to just step down, like, you know what, I'm just going to give up. And amazingly so, it causes a big rift with him and his family. The young woman he's courting, their family doesn't want him to be involved. And not for the reasons that you think. I mean, you might think, oh, because he dropped out and he's no longer, you know, prestigious. But actually, the people, his family, his mother and father, and the mother and father of the young woman he was courting, Mary Agnes, they were against him because he didn't stand up and fight for the truth. They wanted him to stand up against the institution, the University of Penn, the dean who expelled him. They actually asked him to apologize to a white student and to his white professor for cheating. The issue was that he supposedly copied his essay, the beginning of his essay, from a white student, when that actually wasn't the case. And his family knew that, and his the female friend that he was courting, their family knew that, and they were mad at him because he didn't stand up. On one side of the fence, his father wanted him to apologize and just keep going with his studies and not give up. And on the other side, people actually wanted him to fight for the truth. One of the interesting things, he's also one of the founders of the first African-American fraternities, Sigma Pi. I think this is our author on the line. Craig, is this you here?
Yep, I'm on the line.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much. For those of you who are just tuning in, this is Craig T. Williams. He's the author of The Olympian, a beautiful historical fiction. This is his first book. And you can check out more about The Olympian at theolympian.net. That's the website. He's also on Twitter under Vantage. What's your Twitter hook, Craig?
Vintage World.
Vintage World. So please check him out on Twitter. You can find out where he's going to be. So let me start off, Craig. You actually are in the construction business.
Yeah, that's my day job.
That's your day job.
That's how I pay the bills.
That's how you pay the bills. Well, hopefully you're going to be paying the bills with this book, because it's a wonderful book and many people need to pick it up. How did you make this transition to writing this book?
Writing's been a serious hobby for me since college, which is going on 20 years now. And just off and on, working on different projects. I've got several projects at various stages of completion. And, this is the first one that I've been able to bring out and publish.
So why this character? Why James Taylor? Why not something else?
John is just a fascinating personality. I stumbled across his story after being reintroduced to the period of history by way of refamiliarizing myself with Jack Johnson's story. And when I learned about John and his accomplishments, particularly those outside of the Olympic Games, I just couldn't shake his story and realized that it was something that I just had to work on.
Now, you got to tell the audience what parts are true, what parts are not. I just mentioned to them earlier briefly about his battle in school and being accused of cheating. Is that one of the true facts of his life there?
It's funny. Everybody goes right to that as a big question.
That's the conflict. That's the conflict there. People have to
is,
go to that part.
It is. And actually, that period of his life is what was really convincing to me that this was a story that I could tell. The truth of the matter is that there really was no explanation as to why he left school. And he was originally admitted to the Wharton School, left for a period of time, and then returned to the School of Veterinary Medicine. So it was a real opportunity to, explore the drama of his life. And
yes.
So, you know, that part of it was intended to really depict the environment that he grew up in. You know,
mm-hmm.
this was still a very racially tense, very racially oppressive period of history.
1905, you're talking about, 1905. Yeah,
yeah. And so it was my way of acknowledging the struggle that he had to have gone through.
Well, I have to tell you, when you wrote this book, you made me want to marry him. He was such a gentleman. You made him out to such a gentleman. And I want to read, I mean, I'm serious. This is wrong. You shouldn't do this to women, Craig, writing books like this. You know, then our expectations of other men in our lives are going to be like, they need to be like Taylor. But let me read this poem that's in the book. This is a poem in the book here that he gave to the woman he was courting, Mary Agnes. The river bends without losing its way. The sun shines brightly, sharing its warmth. The trees stretch magnificently, sharing their glory, just as you smile and share your heart with the world. I am honored to know you, much prouder to be your friend. The secrets of your spirit are not locked within. They flow from your every word, every graceful step you take. You are on the way to something big, a proud lady and a grand poet. You play the part of a real-life lady. I love the way you perform. You've touched my life in such a way I couldn't help but acknowledge your splendor and make an attempt at writing a poem for a poet, by writing you and my story. Craig, what are you doing? Now, is that a true poem, or did you write that poem?
Well, I wrote that.
You wrote that?
Yeah, and you know, that reflects my sensibilities about what is appealing to me about women, but also, you know, I tried to put myself in his shoes and you know, dial the clock back to that period when courtship was a real tradition. You know, the Victorian era had a very different culture, you know, and the way that men interacted with women, the pace was a lot slower. But also, you know, a woman's spirit and her interests and how she expresses herself is what I find appealing, you know. It's way more than just a pretty face.
Well, that's good to hear, and I'm sure your wife appreciates that. One of the experiences you talk about is that, you know, he was accepted to Wharton, and in the book you mentioned about a trip he took to the New York Stock Exchange. But he was a little, I think this is where he made a shift in his thinking about what he wanted to do with his life, and he decided to go into veterinary medicine. Talk to the audience about where he got that idea about going into helping animals.
Well, again, you know, the story is based on researchable facts, and you can string together a series of true elements of his life story, but there isn't always a clear explanation, and there really wasn't a ton of information available about John. So as, you know, the writer, you look to connect the dots and tie it together, and so he was admitted to the Wharton School, which is a very prestigious business program at the University of Pennsylvania, but he ended up finishing up as a doctor of veterinary medicine. And so I tried to realistically depict how he may have had a conflict. Perhaps he was advised, or, you know, it seemed the best path for him to go into business, but his heart was really with caring for animals. And I tried to show that he had a genuine interest in caring for animals and came to that realization, and perhaps that was part of his decision to return to school as a vet.
Yes. One of the issues you talk about, which I love, you bring up Philadelphia a lot. You talk about the University of Pennsylvania. I used to work there. You talk about College Hall. You talk about the bottom. In the book, he lives on Woodland Avenue. Many people may not be aware of that. Right now, Woodland Avenue is a very rundown part of the section, but at one time, it was a beautiful part of the city, wonderful housing there. And also, you talk about his escapades down near 7th and Lombard. I used to play at a playground at 6th and Lombard, which is still there, and there used to be like aid organizations there that helped him a long time ago. But let me just read this part. This is his trip down to 7th and Lombard. He's trying to become a man now. Basically, because he resigned from school in your story, his father is like, okay, well, you better bring some money into the house. So he decides to make this journey. It reads, "The journey was somewhat intoxicating as I crossed the Chestnut Street Bridge, dizzied by the uncertainty of this forbidden voyage. I wasn't looking forward to the ward itself, for I felt that the ward and I had little in common with each other. However, I was eager to establish my manhood and prove to my parents that I could get a decent job and make my own way. I must have walked for more than an hour, heading to a place I thought I'd never go without permission. But men don't need permission, I kept reminding myself. I was familiar with the path, of course. After all, this was the route our family traveled to church every Sunday. But just one block from the 7th Ward, I became intensely aware that once I had taken a single step past our place of worship, the air changed. Poverty had a smell." So right now, though, you know, 7th and Lombard is one of the most expensive places to live in the city.
Sure.
Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But in the past,
gentrification is something else.
You know? So, well, talk to me about your historical, like, how many hours a week did you spend looking up the history of the Philadelphia, of the University of Penn, to write the book?
Well, there were quite a few hours of research. I mean, that part of the story was really to show the contrast, because the Taylor family, I think, was somewhat unusual in the landscape of African-American families economically. The father, John Taylor Sr., was described as a successful businessman in newspaper clippings that were available. And when I located the family burial plot, it was very apparent by the prominence of the tombstone that this was a family at least of middle to upper middle class standing. So
yes.
His experience, you know, going to the best schools and what have you, was, I imagine, a fairly unique one. And I wanted to really show clearly the typical experience of African Americans at that time. And the Seventh Ward was a ghetto, and it was a location where the now free African Americans kind of congregated in a neighborhood, somewhat corralled. And so it was impoverished, and you know, there was an element of criminality, and you know, a lot of the kind of typical characteristics.
Prostitution.
Slums.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he came across a prostitute. But you know what, one of the things that I liked about that section of the book, I know that sounds kind of weird, prostitute and I liked, but let me finish. One of the things is that you, the prostitute, the woman, you showed her as a woman, because in the end, she wanted to be with him, and she didn't ask money. He thought she wanted money from him.
Right.
But she just wanted to be with him, and she was like, look, this is my job. I have to make money for my children, but I'm still a human being, and so it's like, it shows the different sides of human beings. We're not all one thing. When you look at, don't judge a book by its cover. I think that's what that character, that the prostitute that you brought in, is that it showed she had to make money doing this, lack of education or whatever the reasons are. We could put a lot of things in there. But she was still a human, and she just wanted his companionship. And I thought that was an interesting twist in your story.
Well, sure. The humanity of the characters is always the most critical element. And it's the circumstances. You know, I really wanted to show that this was a really interesting period of history, and exploring John's story really helped me understand that period of history a lot better, because this was post-emancipation, prior to Jim Crow, known as the Progressive Era. But, you know, the African-American community, for the most part, was fairly in limbo. You know, no longer
mm-hmm.
slaves, but in general, not quite
free. Not necessarily free. Right, exactly.
And not readily able to participate in society economically and socially. And so, you know, this was a very difficult circumstance that the vast majority of African Americans found themselves in. And I think, you know, John's experience was somewhat removed from that. Because of his family, as well as, you know, because of his athletic talent and opportunity, but you know, this was a situation that most African Americans struggled with, and it's not entirely unrelated to a large part of our experience even today.
Well, let's talk about his athletic prowess. He was one of the best quarter milers in the country at the time. And but one of the things you talked about, he had a hernia when he was going to Olympus. Was that something you found historically, or is that just something you added with the story?
No, that was part of the research.
That was part of the research.
Yeah.
But he kept going. He was called the Black Eagle. Tell the audience, how did he get the name the Black Eagle?
Well, that was one of my embellishments again.
That was one of your embellishments. Okay, it was a good one.
Yeah.
It was a good one.
I mean, you know, I attempted to, and I hope I did a good job of transporting to that period, and where sometimes identifying somebody by their race, which today would be fairly unacceptable, would be complimentary, you know, in that period
mm-hmm.
of time. And so it was a a positive nickname that one of his early coaches gave him that just kind of stuck and he embraced.
Well, you quote a lot of wonderful literature within your own book, and one of them is Charles Dickens. I just want to read this little section. This is in the chapter 25 of your book. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of audience. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. And I think his life in the story that you wove shows he had wonderful things happening on one side and then some negative things happening. I mentioned earlier to the audience about him traveling with his team but having to stay in the Negro quarters. This is something that elite African-Americans had to deal with. And then your story also, you talk about Jack Johnson. He in the story, you have him with a scene with the famous boxer, Jack Johnson. But he's in the ward. He's staying in a hotel in the ward. He's not staying in a luxury hotel in other part of the city. He, even though he has all the money, you know, a lot of money for that time for African-American, the prestige, he can't stay with him. The whites would go see him, but they don't want him to sleep in the bed next to them.
Sure.
So that's also one of the things you bring up in your book. And actually, you end your book, I think you really admire Jack Johnson. Talk to me about that, your feelings toward Jack Johnson as Craig, your feelings to him.
Sure. Well, it was actually being reintroduced to Jack Johnson that led me to John Taylor. I happened to catch a clip from a documentary about fighters, and the interview was with Muhammad Ali, and he was explaining his admiration for Jack Johnson. And the way that he went into it, you know, I had heard of Jack Johnson before. I had seen The Great White Hope and didn't like it very much. And Ali's comments just made me rethink what I knew about Jack Johnson. And so I really went into a in-depth research on him and found his story to be quite profound. And he's one of the more misunderstood figures in history, and in my estimation, one of the more important figures in history. And this was a seminal moment that he was at the center of as well in 1908 that really impacted the idea of race and the relationship between the races profoundly at that time. And so re-familiarizing myself or learning a more in-depth understanding of Jack Johnson's life and what his life meant really made me curious about that period of history. And I wanted to know, you know, who else was doing things, what else was going on. And that's how I stumbled across John's story. And so, you know, Jack Johnson is someone who, you know, if you ask people about Jack Johnson today, the first thing that usually comes out of their mouth is, oh, that's the guy that dated the white women.
Yeah, that's like the first thing. But see, that goes back to people wanting conflict. They want the juicy part. You know, they're not going to pay attention to other parts. But
sure. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I'm glad that at the end of the book you did expound on his life a little bit and some of the things that you know, he dealt with, because there's a lot of misconceptions about him.
Well, the main thing, if I can just add this quickly, is that, you know, Jack Johnson's journey, his struggle to achieve the things that he achieved, he was really a hero to the black community. And later on, he was somewhat vilified, and his story was, I believe, distorted. And he, you know, was characterized very differently in retrospect. But at the time in 1908, you know, here was a guy from the black community that was striving to an unattainable accomplishment, very much like Barack Obama most recently running for president. You know, Jack Johnson's pursuit of the heavyweight title was extremely similar to Obama's journey.
Yeah, nobody wanted him to get that title, and the guy, you know, he followed him around the country. You talk about that in the book. Let's go back to
so
Taylor
he
a little
must
bit.
Have been a hero. He must have been one of John's heroes, and that was something that I really wanted to illustrate.
Yeah, I think you definitely show that in the book, and people should pick up a copy of The Olympian. You can check out Craig's website, theolympian.net, and learn more about Craig, the author, and also about his book and where he's going to be. One of the things he is part of historically is the founding of one of the first black fraternities. Mm-hmm. Talk to the audience about that.
Oh, yeah, the Sigma Pi Phi fraternity was the first black professional Greek letter organization, and John was one of the first members. He wasn't one of the founders, but he was recruited to join that group in its first year, so I guess he would be considered a charter member. And I imagine that John's accomplishments to that point, you know, being a world-renowned athlete and a student at an Ivy League school, and you know, his fame was part of the reason why he was recruited to join that organization. And I think he was a very important member at its inception.
Well, I think that's another thing that people are not aware of. And that's one of the great things about your book. You just bring so many historical facts to light about Philadelphia, about Jack Johnson, about Taylor himself, about the culture and the issues that people were dealing with. But one of the things that I'll go back to, and I talk a lot about youth and issues that youth are facing, and for young black men, I think in reading the book, as a positive example of what a man can be and keeping his integrity, I think is one of the bright lights in the book, just highlighting a young man really trying to stay on the path who had support, and from unexpected places. I mean, he had support not just from his family, but you bring in certain characters, which I believe probably are true in some degree. You find angels in unsuspecting places. He had white students that maybe supported him. I'm not sure if that's something you found in your research or you made up, but I think in life you do find angels in unexpected places. What do you think that... Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, I tried to portray a balanced landscape of characters. You know, certainly he had to have encountered a tremendous amount of racial conflict, but mm-hmm. Certainly there were Caucasian colleagues and associates and friends that he had to have had. I mean, particularly because he was such a popular person, you know, the descriptions of his funeral were very diverse, you know, the people that
mm-hmm.
the outpouring of love for him at the time of his death, there was no racial distinction within it.
Well, one of the things, we only have a couple minutes left, but he did go to the Olympics in Europe. Now, one of the things you talk about is that they protested because one of their teammates was caught supposedly cheating. Was that one of the true historical facts, that they did protest against?
Yep.
They stood on the sidelines?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that here he was, you know, at the birth of the modern Olympic Games as we know them, and he was at the center of what is till this day, you know, one of the biggest controversies ever to occur within the Olympic Games. And that's all true. That's all absolute fact.
So he protested, but he also was unable to get an individual gold, but he got a gold as a team. Is that one of the true facts also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, his gold medal was received as part of the sprint medley team. He ran the quarter-mile leg on the sprint, the relay, the sprint relay. And but he was in the finals for the gold medal for the quarter mile. And, of course, the controversy, in my opinion, robbed him of the opportunity for that individual gold, which may have elevated his fame considerably had he won that individual gold.
Well, it's an amazing story. I wish you much success with the book. I hope everyone can pick up a copy of The Olympian by Craig T. Williams. Again, you can check out his website, theolympian.net. You can also find him on Twitter. They're on Facebook. So follow them on Twitter, check them out on Facebook. You can like them, as they say now, become a fan. I'm going to give away a copy of The Olympian to a lucky person. You can email me what city Jack Johnson was born in. SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. Email me what city Jack Johnson was born in, and I will send you a free copy of The Olympian. Thank you so much, Craig, for coming on this morning.
Thank you for having me on. It was great.
Wish you much success, and please stay in contact. And any new books you might have coming out, you can come back on the show.
Absolutely. There will be more. Stories of Heroes.
There will be more. Excellent. All right. Check out Craig T. Williams on theolympian.net. Have a wonderful day, Craig.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening today. I just got off the phone with Craig T. Williams, author of The Olympian. He talks about John Taylor, one of the first, John Baxter Taylor, one of the first African-American Olympians, won a gold medal for America. Many of you may not know about him. This was in the early 1900s. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, became a veterinarian, just so many wonderful things. So you need to pick up a copy of his book. Earlier today, I spoke to Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She has a new book, Surviving and Thriving, 365 Facts About Black Economic History. Also spoke with journalist Linda Pullman, The Crisis Caravan. You need to check out all these wonderful authors. I want to thank you again for all your support, and you have a wonderful Saturday. You can follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. Become a fan on Facebook. Just look me up, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I hope you have a wonderful Saturday.